drops are falling on my head. And just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head and they keep falling. So
I gotta tell you, I had to play it one more time. I went through the headache of downloading it. I gotta play it one more time. I mean, especially, look, how often do you have a president who says, I didn't go to something that historically would be remembered for years. I didn't become part of history because it was raining. Fred is going to get my whatever the heck that is on his head wet. Just crazy. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on yesterday. This is one of those bizarre things. Yesterday was the third anniversary of the attack in France that killed 130 people. And how did Trump commemorate the third anniversary of that horrible tragedy? By attacking the French people, saying that, they could have been learning German. They were learning German if it weren't for us. Here to share some thoughts on all of that, our good friend Sarah Kenzie. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you buy in the rain, Secret Service, helicopters don't fly, cars don't drive.
No, this is all crap. It's not because of the rain. Trump has golfed in the rain. Trump actually took the freaking ice bucket challenge. Trump is afraid of many things like democracy and stairs, but he's not afraid of water. And, this is basically, a rejection once again of Western alignments. It's him placating Putin. I think it's a genuine hostility he has toward Western European countries that you can date all the way back to the late 1980s, where, even then he was treating NATO, kind of like a mafia protection racket, that he felt was ripping us off. He doesn't, understand how these alignments works, or he has a very sort of, late 80s Soviet era perspective on this. And so, it shouldn't be interpreted as Trump being eccentric or, rain-averse. He is actively hostile, and he's trying to undermine the stability of the Western order. And, this entire commemoration was, in honor of those who died during, a battle that, at least for a time, brought, the end of World War One was like the end of the worst war that had ever happened at that point in European history. And after, millennia of battles between Germany and France, and like this is a very, difficult thing for people to recall. That war for them was much greater than it was for the United States. I don't necessarily expect Trump to know this, but is this what he did was cruel. It was insulting. It was cruel. It was, a real stab at the dignity of, the countries involved. And then to do it again on the anniversary of the massacre, to go after France like this, like it's so disgraceful. It's so heartless. And it's the kind of thing I think they're not going to forget. Even if Trump is out of office, they're going to remember that the Republicans did not condemn him for this level of cruelty. They're not going to look at us as a trustworthy partner. And it's because people are not trying to check Trump and put him in place within our own country.
Yeah, I mean, globally, we are doing irreparable harm to our reputation and the alliances we've held close for so long. And you're right. I mean, you look at the photos from the event that he did show up to, and he was mopey-faced, head down, until the moment he got to see his bromance. And he was all smiles around Putin.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I've only seen Trump smile like that basically three times in his life. Once was when Lavrov and Kislyak visited him in the Oval Office. And I just remember being struck by that. That was right after Trump had fired Comey, and the three of them were laughing about it. And he looked just genuinely relaxed, genuinely happy and at ease. He smiled like that when he saw Putin this weekend. And the other photo that it reminded me of is Trump with Roy Cohn in the 1980s, where he just, he's almost unrecognizable when he has a look of actual joy on his face, because Trump doesn't smile. He sneers or he smirks. He doesn't laugh. He doesn't have friendships. And the only thing I've seen that's kind of close to that level of warmth in a relationship is with Cohn and with various members of the Russian mafia or Kremlin officials. And that's a really disturbing thing. You don't even see it with him and his own family members, or even with his fans, you know, where you would think that relationship would exist because of the blind adoration that he craves. It's just with these kind of dominating male criminal figures in his life. And that's very disturbing.
That is disturbing. But, you know, on a certain level, you can almost go, well, you know who Trump is. He doesn't show up to the thing in France. And for whatever the reason is, did he have a temper tantrum because he got shellacked in the midterms? Did his bagel not have butter on it? Who knows? But to not show up on Monday to Arlington, and Pence didn't go either. It's one thing to snub, the French, especially if you hate them anyway, but to come home and to snub we the people, that's a whole nother level of childish and petulant and just idiocy.
I think it's worse. I think he hates the troops. He hates the veterans. He's terrified by the concept of sacrifice, that you would do something for your country, that you do something beyond yourself. But it's so consistent. You see this in his attacks on individual veterans, like with McCain, with Hizer Han and his family, with the widow of LaDavid Johnson. You see it in the mismanagement of the VA, where he appointed a bunch of his Mar-a-Lago cronies to run it. Now they're denying GI benefits to troops. He hasn't visited any troops abroad, anybody in active duty. He's taking, military forces and positioning them at, like, a Whataburger in Texas to ward off a fictional migrant horde that's heading towards Tijuana, if you could even consider it an actual, noteworthy event. Like, he has completely abused the military, and he treats them with such disrespect and disdain, and it's incredibly consistent. It goes all the way back to his own bone spurs claims. I think he looks at the military as a bunch of suckers. He can't believe that anyone would actually make this level of sacrifice, because he just weaseled his way out of it, and so he looks down on them. And I think that Pence going along with this is another level of it's extremely disturbing, because Pence is more apt to at least feign normalcy, to pretend to care. And if he's not even caring, like, I don't know why anybody who's a veteran, or who is in the military would back Trump in this administration at this point, when he treats them, with such contempt.
Yeah, but I've been saying this for years. I don't know why anyone who was in the military would back the Republicans. They show up for their photo ops and they use them as props, but yet, time and time again, what we see is, well, they didn't have body armor going into war. They don't get the benefits that they're entitled to through the VA. In fact, the whole scheme to privatize and profitize the VA should be one of those things that every veteran is inflamed about.
Yeah, absolutely. And it should be covered more in the media. Like, I'm not sure people realize the extent of this. And then you also have, problems with healthcare. You have problems with PTSD. And, my generation and people a little younger, a little older than me, we're the ones who, not me personally, but people I know, fought in these wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and have not gotten the health care services they need. They have not gotten job opportunities. They're often struggling financially. Their spouses are often struggling. Their children are. Like, we have an entire generation affected by this mistreatment. And, they simply don't care. And in Trump's case, I think, get some sort of perverse satisfaction on making people's life worse. And if there was ever a day to try to, begin to remedy that and start to do the right thing, it would be Veterans Day. But instead, it was just, more salt in the wound.
Yeah, I've said for years that, I grew up as a kid in the early 70s, and I watched as, all the guys were coming back from Vietnam, and, the housing project I grew up in, where a lot of, it's the poor people who fight and die in war. Where all these poor guys were coming back with broken minds, broken bodies, horrible drug and alcohol problems, and they were just dumped. In fact, my first image of someone, in the military, was a guy that we found dead on the side of a neighbor's house with a needle in his arm.
Oh,
and and I've said, even when Bush, got us into those misadventures in Iraq and Afghanistan, I said, my only hope here is my kids never see what I saw growing up as a kid, and we don't treat veterans like that ever again. And sadly, the more you peel back you know, these stories, you find out we're doing the exact same thing, only we're hiding it better.
Yeah, no, it's the same problem. And, you know, I think now, because there's such class stratification, you know, often in who enlists in the military for reasons, and a lot of people doing it to try to pay bills, trying to get through college, whereas, you know, wealthier people will shun it completely. And then you have a media dominated by wealthy people who are able to, you know, get their advanced degrees, get their unpaid internships, et cetera. Like, it replicates itself. And so I think a lot of times people aren't aware, how pervasive the problem is.
Yeah, it's crazy. Let's move on. Evidently, you know, John Kelly's leaving again. The adult is leaving the room.
I mean, allegedly, like, everyone is quitting. I mean, which generally I'm like, good. Like, you're all terrible. I mean, I'm not going to mourn the departure of Kelly, who, again, when you want to talk about, being horrible to veterans and to troops, he's certainly an example of that. You know, he was terrible to, the widow, Lyndon B. Johnson's wife, about a year ago. And, you know, he's a bigot. He's been an accessory to all of the corruption of the Trump administration. When Sessions left, I was glad. He's an utter disgrace as an attorney general. There are these people who are like, oh, no, you know, now the Mueller probe might be in trouble because Sessions gone. And I'm just like, what reality are you on where Sessions is ever going to protect the Mueller probe from Trump? Like, Sessions is implicated in the Mueller probe. He lied on his clearance forms. He met illicitly with a bunch of Russians. Like, he totally wants the Mueller probe to sink. And it makes real difference in the safety of it, whether he's there or not. Like, I don't see an enormous gulf between him and Whitaker, except that Sessions was just slicker. And allegedly, Sarah Huckabee Sanders is going. That might matter because I think she's someone who's, you know, good at her job, and her job is being terrible. And she's much more skillful at that than Sean Spicer was. But, at the heart of all of these alleged departures is basically this classic autocratic strategy where you fire people, you shake things up to create this kind of void, and then you fill that void with loyalists. And the longer an autocrat stays in power, the smaller the circle around him tends to get, you know, reflecting paranoia, occasionally reflecting a level of scrutiny into crime, which we certainly are having here with the Mueller probe. And I think that that's just what he's doing, and I don't think that anyone who comes in is going to be better. They're very likely to be worse, but there still should be no reward for any of these people in these positions, you know, who've disgraced their role, which was to serve the United States and its people.
Yeah, you're right on Sarah Huckabee Sanders. She is good at her job. I mean, I guess soulless is one of the qualifications for that job, I guess.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And she, you know, her style of delivery, the fact that she's a woman, the fact that she knows how to con the media into taking her side, like when they all, you know, targeted Michelle Wolf, after Wolf had very accurately characterized the relationship between the White House press corps and Sarah Huckabee Sanders and other propagandists. She's good at that. Sean Spicer would explode into these fits of rage and accidentally reveal, you know, critical info to the White House, you know, things that kind of give us a hint of what's actually going on. And I think that's why they got rid of him. Whereas, you know, she's a blank slate that just compulsively lies, and that's what she's there to do. And, you know, it'll be good if she's gone, but I suspect they'll replace her with, you know, somebody equally adept at it, now that they understand the White House press corps that they're dealing with, and, you know, they know they're not going to stand up for themselves that much, and they know how to manipulate them.
Yeah, and if they don't like him, they'll just throw him out, you know, like they did with Acosta.
Yeah.
And accuse him of, I guess, what's it up to now? Did he stab the intern now? Is that what we're being told?
Yes, the intern was gruesomely murdered in plain sight, yet somehow we covered the whole thing up. I mean, you know, I'm glad to see, I guess, CNN and Fox are, you know, joining together to make sure that nobody's press pass is revoked. But I really just, like, this is too little, too late. Like, those two networks in particular have been kissing Trump's ass since day one. I mean, obviously Fox is just like his, you know, it's his propaganda network. It's state propaganda. CNN is more on the bubble, but they've hired a number of Trump's, you know, sometimes current, but often former Trump campaign employees as pundits. Jeff Zucker, of course, was who brought Trump to mainstream appeal in this century with The Apprentice. They have their own little ties. It's good, broadly speaking, that they're trying to stand up for press freedom, but I don't know. I don't see this going anywhere. I think that what they should really do is just, like, send, you know, one or two people to these press briefings, put them on C-SPAN, have those people ask the questions, you know, from the pool, and have the White House press corps go out and do some actual reporting on the effects of these policies on American life, like, and not just this palace intrigue, you know, kind of nonsense, and not these lies from Sarah Huckabee Sanders that they end up having to spend the rest of the day just debunking. You know, it's a waste of everybody's time, and I'd rather know, you know, what's actually going on in the White House and going on in the country.
Yeah, it seems like we could use those resources better, because you're right, she's just going to lie anyway. You know, I don't know that anything factual has come out of this administration, you know, on any level, and I think that's how they like it, because what you've got is you've got, you know, the press corps, they're chasing their tails.
Yeah, and, you know, there's something we said for, you know, not just debunking the lie, but analyzing the nature of it. You know, why did they lie in this particular way? You know, what are they trying to accomplish? That's never how the press treats it. You know, you occasionally get, like, an outlier, somebody like, you know, Greg Sargent from the Washington Post. I don't think he's White House press corps, but he's good at, you know, doing this sort of thing, like breaking down lies. And there are other columnists, analysts, or people like George Lakoff, who's a, you know, professor of linguistics, who's, you know, given advice on how to handle this kind of pathological lying and propaganda. But the majority of the people who show up at those press briefings just reiterate it, and then it spreads. And then they have to issue these sort of, you know, qualifiers of, oh, yeah, actually, this is, you know, total bullshit, and we just echoed a bunch of things that were made up. Sorry about that, everybody. And it just, you know, the cycle goes on and on and on, and it just doesn't do anybody any good.
Yeah, I wanted to get your thoughts on what's going on down in Florida and Georgia. I mean, you know, now the Democrats have taken the House, I've said that, you know, obviously the first thing that they should be doing is investigating all of the shenanigans that went on, especially in Georgia and in Kansas, where you had the Secretary of State as the gubernatorial candidate. But Georgia in particular, where I've read, you know, upwards of, you know, 1.5 million voters were purged from their voting rolls over the last couple of years. And you look at this, and it's just a ripoff. I mean, I love how the Republicans are saying, you know, the elections are being stolen when they've already stolen them.
Yeah, they've been working on this in Georgia for a long time, and the same things happened in 2016. You know, and there's also foreign interference in Georgia. You know, Kislyak was down in Georgia. The server was wiped, you know, that held information about the ballots cast by Brian Kemp, and, you know, was never returned. So they were never able to do an actual investigation into whether the machines had been tampered with. And all of this was reported throughout 2017, but played down an enormous amount. You know, when I wrote about both domestic voter suppression, you know, things that are a result of the partial VRA repeal, you know, which we're also seeing in Florida, you know, and would include information about potential machine tampering or likely machine tampering in the case of Georgia, you know, editors just freaked out. You know, my final article for The Correspondent, you know, starts off with a discussion of Georgia and warnings that we really need to examine what's happening in Georgia before the midterms. And I wrote that a year ago, and, you know, that was it with me for them, because they got bought out by an American kind of conglomeration and, you know, wouldn't ever run anything like that. But I was right, and I think that there, for whatever reason, is enormous hesitancy to really look at this problem until now, when it's so stark and what Kemp is doing is so vile. And I think Stacey Abrams has been very good at holding her ground and demanding transparency and demanding all votes be counted and just sort of a look at the whole process, like who was disenfranchised, were the machines tampered with, you know, all of these things that are completely legitimate questions to ask when you have a party like the Republicans with a track record of this and with open intent of becoming a one-party state. You know, these are not like paranoid conspiratorial inquiries. They reflect what we've all seen with our own eyes happening on the ground. So I'm glad she's doing that. And I'm glad also that, you know, Andrew Gillum, you know, sort of retracted his concession and said, you know, let's wait. Let's make sure everybody's vote counts. This is a part of the Democratic process that we can't afford to dismiss. And so that's good. That's what they should be doing, is, you know, not just standing up for themselves, but standing up for citizens and their right to vote.
Yeah, I mean, well, if you're going to talk about, you know, supporting veterans, making sure that their votes are actually counted, you know, I think kind of important. I mean, because a lot of them vote via absentee ballot, and the fact that, I guess, we don't count those most of the time.
Yeah, Trump is trying to get them thrown out in Florida. Like, he's deliberately trying to throw out veterans' ballots. Like, you know, this is, again, it joins this extremely long list of hostile actions towards troops and towards veterans. And so, yeah, it's enormously frustrating. This is an anti-American president, and there are very few actions he takes that are not in line with, you know, disrespecting and hurting this country.
Yeah, last question I've got for you. Do you see any hope for Abrams in Georgia or Gillum and Nelson in Florida?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially for Abrams, you know, they've just got to stay strong, and I hope that they have the legal support necessary, and I hope that they're not shy about, you know, suing and pursuing and doing whatever they need to do until they get clear answers on what occurred and, you know, a clear statement of integrity, because what happens here sets a precedent for future elections, which we know well because we all remember 2000 and a lot of unresolved problems from that election, and, of course, 2016, and unresolved problems from that election. And when you don't tackle them head on, you know, they just flare up again in the years to come. So this isn't just about them. It's about the future. But I think they certainly understand that, and I've noticed, like, a bit more toughness within the Democratic Party, you know, before the midterms and after, where they seem to grasp that this is not just partisan politics as usual, but a serious threat, you know, the threat of authoritarianism, and they're just not taking the Republicans' crap anymore, and that's what they should do.
Now it's about time.
You know, because they should be representing the people. Yeah, it is about time. It's like it's a little late, but better than never, and, you know, they need to stick to it.
Yeah, we'd be a whole different country if Al Gore had taken that approach. Just saying. But Sarah, I appreciate the time, the thoughts. Always great talking with you.
Yes, thank you.
As always, our good friend Sarah Kendzior. Make sure you follow her on Twitter at Sarah Kendzior. Also, don't forget to get the podcast, Gaslit Nation. Fantastic bit of podcast. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Raindrops are falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head, and they keep falling.